I leverage those. Sorry. It's great to see David Cox here today. I know you've been sick. We're excited to have you with us. Pete, I'm glad to see you in the back as an encouragement to all of us. We have families that have newborns that are starting a new life as Christians. We have young couples that are looking to start lives together. And all of those things have to center around spirituality. So, the book of Hebrews points to the ideas surrounding why they should stay faithful their entire lives. So when we look at the target audience of the book of Hebrews, and what the theme of the book of Hebrews is, the theme of the book of Hebrews is be faithful to Christ no matter what. Stay faithful. This is, you know, and the target audience here will be Hebrew Christians. And the messaging that will be presented to them will be from that standpoint so they can draw upon their past history and their experiences and the prophecies to build their faith. Particularly, it points out the idea that Christ is superior to the angels and Moses. The Hebrews would have considered Moses to be a great leader. He would have been one of their instrumental leaders. Abraham, no doubt, the father of their nation. But Jesus, Christ himself, is greater than even Moses as a leader and a prophet. Christ is above the angels. In the Old Testament time, what were angels capable of doing? And what do we know that they have done? They won wars. How many thousands of people were slain as a function of the angels acting on the behalf of the children of Israel? And they would have grown up knowing those things and how great an angel was. But yet Jesus is greater than the angels. Christ's priesthood and ministry. So when we're looking at the things that be faithful to Christ no matter what, his priest and ministry are superior to that of Levi. Do we have Levitical priests today? No, we don't. Was the Levitical priesthood intended to be all enduring? No. Is the priesthood of Christ intended to be all enduring? Yes. It's something that we can depend on from now on. It's therefore much greater and superior to that of Levi. So why would the Jews want to turn back to it? When we look at sacrifices in the Old Testament, what was the point of a sacrifice? And this starts to be some of the things that we'll need to think about in the book of Hebrews. So as you're doing study work, remind yourself of the Old Testament references to sacrifices and other things, because the book of Hebrews in many ways leverages parallels and makes distinctions between what was done in one section in the old versus the new and how different they really are. Sacrifices were, for the high priest, were offered on the Day of Atonement, were they not? And the only time the high priest could go into the most holy place was on the Day of Atonement. Did they ever do just one time for all and that was it? They had to continually offer sacrifices. What did Christ do for all of us? He was the perfect sacrifice. One time, we're done. Well, that's, if I don't have to go buy groceries every week, and if I buy groceries once and I'm never hungry again, that's pretty good, is it not? I don't have to pay the bill, I don't have to get hungry, I don't have to do anything else. But in this case, Christ's act on our behalf as a sacrifice enables us all to have hope and be saved. This would have been the messaging to the Jews that they would have needed to understand the differentiation between what the old law had for them and what the new law offered to them, and why it was futile to go back to the old law. It was replaced, absolutely. When we talk about a will or a testament, and this is brought up later in the book as well, when you have the death of a testator, the will is no longer in effect. It's executed, and a new covenant is in place. What's the target audience? We finished up our study in Romans, and that was to the Gentiles. The book of Hebrews' target audience is to Hebrew Christians. Very different backgrounds. So, as we relate to it, how many people grew up in Limestone County? Okay. How many people spent part of their lifetime in another county? Okay? Were the two areas that you grew up in very different? No doubt Lorenzo would say, growing up in Italy, you know, very different backgrounds, very different experiences. Gentiles would have had very different experiences in the book of Romans to leverage than Jews would have as we're talking to them in the book of Hebrews. If I'm trying to approach somebody to teach them and encourage them, what do I also have to know? You need to know something about their background. Where is their thought process? How do you appeal to that in order to be able to convey your message in a way that will be relatable to them? There are things within this book, and there will be techniques that part of the time we'll spend emphasizing the techniques that the writer uses to try to make that appeal. Because I think it's very important for us to understand that and be able to leverage it the same way as we're talking to people that we meet. The Jewish Christians at this time were the target audience, and they were facing intense persecution. Now, for us to understand that, we also have to understand the timing and the period of the book, and that's the next section that we'll talk about. But the messaging in the book itself makes the point about them facing persecution. Why would they want to return back to a former manner of life, and why the distinctions that are there? Just to go ahead and talk briefly about the timing, we're looking somewhere in the period of the AD 60 to 66, probably for the writing of the book. And if we look at what's central in that time period from a persecution standpoint, we do know that the Jews were persecuted, or Jewish Christians were persecuted, even shortly after stoning of Stephen. But this is much later than that. This is later as it relates to, more than likely, the persecution associated with Emperor Nero and his work against the Jewish Christians. The target audience was also Jewish Christians that were toying with returning to Judaism. They would have been looking back to something that's comfortable. As a Jewish Christian, and they were seeing this target persecution particularly, it would have been stronger. Because in the case of Nero and him labeling Christians as the ones that helped facilitate burning down Rome and blaming them for it, they were sought out even more so than Jews alone, those that proclaimed to be Christians. Many of the people of this time would have been people who had grown up after the miracles that were presented by the apostles and by the men that had their hands laid upon them. They would have not been individuals that would have seen the mighty works of Jesus, more than likely, if the timing of this works out. If we go back to the story of the Old Testament and we look at a similar situation, what do we learn in the book of Judges? There's a generation that grew up that did not know the mighty works of God, and as a result, they were not faithful. They were presented with additional challenges because of that, that didn't seem to be as strong or as binding in their lives as those that had seen the mighty works. The location, who may have been, these are Jewish Christians. The location or the target audience of the book with respect to a geographical location is not known. There are several that are pointed out as possibilities. It could have been written to Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. No doubt these Christians would have been ones that are now close to facing the destruction of Jerusalem and the sieges associated with that. Kind of depends on the timing. It could have been written to Jews that were in Asia Minor. It could have been written to Jews that were in Alexandria. And I'm backing up, sorry. I need to go back. Alexandria or Rome. It's just not certain. There's not enough information given in the book to say explicitly what the target audience is. But what would all of these people have had in common? A level of persecution. The Roman Empire was, throughout all of these regions, would have had an influence over it, and if indeed the proclamations by Nero extended throughout the entire realm, Jewish Christians would have faced significant persecution as a result. The style of the message. The style of the message in this introduction is an appeal to the Jews. It's a very personal appeal. One of the things that we don't know, though, is the author, This book doesn't just come out and tell us, I'm writing you a letter and here's the one that's writing you the letter. But it is written in a form that is appealing to them not to give up on Christianity and not to turn away from it, and using examples that are very personal to pull on that. If I'm trying to convince someone of my sincerity, I might use personal examples to be able to leverage and create a common bond in that messaging. The author of this book does that by comparison. This book is different in how it's styled. It's non-confrontational, as others, for example, refuting a false doctrine. It's not written like 1 Corinthians, where it's pointing out point-blank sins that you need to correct within the community. It's targeted, again, like we said, the theme of it is not to give up. Serve God faithfully. Serve Jesus faithfully. It heavily draws on Jewish heritage. Throughout the entire book, reference after reference after reference. And we'll look at some of those in particular as we go through our studies, and we'll mention some of them later in the presentation this morning. But the writer of this book is extremely knowledgeable about Jewish history. He cites over and over again different references that even a modern reader of the Bible today, unless they've studied it multiple times, may not notice the subtle reference and tie to a previous scripture. One of the things that I've noticed, and I will try to point out as we go forward in our study over this quarter, is it draws the parallels. And one of the reasons we'll be talking about the parallels, but we'll also be talking about the effective technique of using those parallels in teaching. He draws the comparison between the tabernacle of old and the new covenant. He draws the parallel between the priesthood and the new priesthood. He draws the comparison between the priests of old and priests of now, which are individual Christians. Those are very interesting parallels that you have to look for and see the differences. But it's an effective way to show somebody, particularly these people of that day, knowing their history, to be able to tie the message together. One of the other things about the style of the message is the writing itself. We'll mention this further. It is written in Greek, but it's a very different form of Greek than some of the other epistles and letters. So where was it written from? We don't know. The letter doesn't say specifically. Even the historical accounts differ as to the location that it was written from and where the target audience was. There's only really one phrase in the passage that lends any kind of evidence as to a messaging. And it says, Hebrews 13:24 says, "They of Italy salute you." Well, when we sit down and critically look at that messaging, what does that mean? What can that mean? Well, it could mean it could be written from Italy. It could be written from, hello, this is a group of individuals that are sending you this message that are from Italy. It's not specific. It'd be different if it said, we're sending you this to you from Rome. But it just says Italy in general, or they of Italy, which it could be a group of from Italy. There's no secular history to leverage on this. Some of our events and more of the archaeological evidence that is uncovered identifies things that we can tie together with secular history. Recent discoveries in Iran and Iraq have tied together some stories associated with the Hittites that weren't known before. Well, in this case, there's not any thus far secular history that tells us how and where this book is written from. It just doesn't exist. There's some attributions as to individuals that might have written the book historically, but they're not specific yet either. And basically we're left to speculate associated with that. Is that a bad thing? Does that change the message of the book? It doesn't. And that's what we're really going to be studying, is the message of the book and what it would have been intended for the target audience. The only thing that in some cases it's helpful to know the writer is to be able to know their thought process. In this particular case, the thought process of the writer is revealed throughout the book and associated with. So when was the book of Hebrews written? Evidence exists that it's no later, obviously, than AD 90 to 96. And one of the reasons being there is Clement of Rome appears to have quoted from the book itself. And he is known to have lived in that time period and some of his writings from that time period. So this is a logical approach to trying to narrow down the storyline. The next piece of evidence that we have, it's probably not likely to have been any later than AD 70. The tenses surrounded with the discussion of the temple are all present tenses and not past tense. It doesn't talk about the temple having been this way. It talks about the temple is this way. So for the temple to have been destroyed in AD 70, you would have been talking about it in past tense and not current tense. The passages associated with that that talk about it is 7 and 8. 9, 6 through 10, and 13, 10, all kind of in that same tense. So we can bound it yet further, no later than AD 70. The mention of Timothy being set free in chapter 13, verse 23, points to a date somewhere in the 60s. Timothy's work and Paul's work would have been occurring in that time frame. Paul would have been imprisoned somewhere between AD 58 and somewhere up to 63. We're not specific exactly as to the time of his death. Traditionally, it's held to be in July of 64. And this is parallel at that point with the accusal that Nero made of the Christians there in Rome of having set fire to Rome. I don't know all of the details surrounding that secular history, but apparently Nero set fire to at least three of the different districts of Rome at that time and then turned around because of retribution associated with his own leadership, attributed it to the Jewish Christians, and blamed the Christians in general for being reprobates and having created these fires. If I'm not mistaken, what I read further is that three of those were known to be attributed to Nero creating that, but as many as 10 out of 14 districts of Rome burned at that time. So it would have been very fresh in the mentality of the people of that time that this was very, very devastating. They would have been looking for a fall guy to be able to blame the destruction on. And the persecution of Christians that ensued at that time was extreme. The gruesome burning of individuals while they're staked to a crucifix was noted throughout history, even to the point of it being appalling to some of the Nero's fellow leaders. This has just gone too far. But dating it that way, we look now at somewhere around AD 64. The Waldrons, in their book, some basically limit it to somewhere between AD 60 and 66. Farrell Jenkins' book, somewhere around AD 65. Some of the other books that we're using ties it between 64 and 66. That leads us to the next point associated with who's the author of the book. We can't tell with certainty. When we look at the book, it doesn't come out and say, "I, Paul, write this letter to you," or "Peter, I write this to you." It comes out and just starts talking about book and the message to the Christians themselves. Early historians do attribute the book to Paul. But why not Paul? He wrote 13 other epistles. Why not attribute this one to him? The style is very different than his other writings. When we even look at handwriting. Now, granted, Paul would have used a scribe, so handwriting analysis wouldn't do us any good. But when we look at how we word things, what's one of the statements in the Bible that says, our speech betrays us, does it not? We're from the South. How do we speak? Well, if you go to Boston, they're going to tell you, you're not from here. If you're writing something and you grew up in the South, the idioms that you use and the words, the structures that you'll use will be different. Y'all fits in real close. North may be you guys. There are phrases that tell things about how we structure it. The book of Hebrews is very different from Paul's other writings. So you'd have to speculate if he chose to change his style, did he dictate it to somebody else and then they wrote it? Or did he choose to change his style in a way that maybe the Jewish Christians themselves didn't look as him at the author, since he had such a detrimental history with the Jews in the past because of his conversion to Christianity? He started out persecuting Christians, was a leader in the Jewish organization, and then changed. Related to that, all 13 epistles are definitively Paul's, start with a greeting. Hebrews does not start with a greeting like the other books. Paul introduces quoted scripture differently than is done in Hebrews. If you look at some of the wording and how he says, he basically introduces when I'm going to quote something, it's done a certain way in his other books, and in Hebrews, it's not done that way. So if my speech betrays me, we would start to build an evidential case here that Paul's speech betrays him as not being the writer for this. He would have had to have done a lot of things to make it come out differently than what his other letters came out. Hebrews is written in the most formal Greek, whereas Paul's other writings are not. And Paul, in many of his other letters, ends up spending time in his messaging defending his apostleship. There's no evidence of that in the book of Hebrews. So who else, if we're looking at authors? If we look at individuals who would have had training, Apollos would have been trained in the formal Greek and knowledge of the Old Testament history to potentially be a writer. As a Levite, Barnabas would have had the intimate knowledge of the rituals around the priesthood, and there's some evidence there and early attribution that Barnabas may have been the writer of the book. There's others that attribute it to Luke and Clement and Silvanus, but you know what? We don't know. There's no definitive way to pin it down, and there's no reason to speculate over it. We have to focus on the message. And as an introduction, generally, this is key to, we cover who the author of a book is and the timing and so on. We have to spend some time on this, but we can't dwell on it. So when we look at the outline of the book, it's in three main divisions. The first division is Jesus is incomparable, yet he becomes a man to fulfill God's divine purposes. And this runs from chapter 1 through the last part of chapter 2. The second part, or second division, therefore consider our high priest, and let us come boldly to God's throne for his blessings. Now, this would have been done in a way to appeal to the Jewish Christians and their understanding of the priesthood of old versus the new priesthood, and how much better the new priesthood is than that of old. In view of his greatness, remain faithful and persevere. They would have been faced with very stiff persecution. When we look at relating to that in our own lives, Sandra and I have this conversation, and as other people we talk to that are experiencing difficulties in their lives, I make the point, as we bring it back to our own congregation, there's not a pew here that hasn't experienced some trauma, whether it be physical or spiritual, with the loss of a family member that's no longer faithful. That can be a discouragement. That can be paralleled to persecution in some ways. And yet the messaging here is, in view of what Christ offers for us, in view of his greatness, in view of the perfectness of his sacrifice and his priesthood and all of those things, remain faithful and persevere. That's how we tie it back and somewhat relate it to our own time And I think there will be multiple opportunities throughout this study of the book of Hebrews to do that exact thing, is to relate it back to our own heritage, our own history, our own experiences, and why we would choose to remain faithful as opposed to fall back. When we move from a particular belief and learn the truth, we end up having to accept that truth and apply it to our lives from that point forward. The Jews would have had that same problem, would they not? They would have been brought up to believe all of the Old Testament. They would have had the benefit of the prophecies that are pointing to the things forward, but what did they not accept? Those that didn't become Christians, they did not accept Christ. They did not accept him as a priest. They didn't understand it. He wasn't of the Levitical line. He couldn't be a priest according to that. But yet, we have the message here again to remain faithful. So, if we look at kind of a observations, the author uses comparisons throughout the book to draw distinctions between the old and the new, to show the superiority of the new. Okay? They were given a covenant at one point, and it passed away. Why wouldn't the new covenant pass away? We were God's chosen people, and we're no longer God's chosen people. Well, if we believe this, why would anything else change? So there's parallels that you have to get past in that teaching to the Jews that this is superior and it is forever. The author is extremely knowledgeable of Old Testament. We've already kind of pointed to this and alluded to it, but passages, and these are just some brief summary passages, and I'm going to pull together some more of that. For example, as we're looking at some of these passages, the author quotes from Genesis 4 and 4. In verse 4 and 4, quotes from Genesis 2 and 2. In 8 and 5, he cites Exodus 25 and 40. From Leviticus, a quote's made in chapter 9, verse 7. We can go on and on. The author has a clear grasp of all of the books and how they interrelate together to make his message plain to the Jews about their history, about the fulfillment of the prophecies, and about the things that are going to come to pass. When we look at the creation, which would have been one of the very first things, obviously, the Old Testament starts with, he cites in 11:3 and 4 and 4. The fall of man associated with the flood in 6 and 8, chapter 6 and 8. The story associated with Cain and Abel is cited in Hebrews 11:4 and 12:24. You keep going through here. The flood cited again in 11:7. Abraham leaving the Ur of the Chaldees in 11:18. If you look at the book itself of Hebrews, you almost get a historical snapshot of the entire Jewish history, just in snippets and in quotations that tie it together. So no doubt the author had a strong understanding of that. Now, what do we know about the books of the and the writings that we have preserved for us? They were inspired by the Holy Spirit. So no doubt the Holy Spirit could have indicated these specific passages. But when we talk about style and how we use the message that we're given, we often leverage our own experiences to be able to tie that information together. So strong evidence here that the author himself had a rich history understanding of the Jews' history. In the next comparison, the author is also very knowledgeable of Jesus' earthly work. And these are passages in the book of Hebrews that cite examples coming from what Jesus did in his ministry. So now we start to narrow it down. The author, we don't know who the author is, but we know some things about this author. He's very knowledgeable about Jewish history. He's very formally trained in formal Greek. He is very knowledgeable about Jesus' early ministry. Could have had some intimate knowledge of that with personal experiences. We don't know. But we just see these evidences over and over again. Now, when we look back at these types of things, and you're trying to convey a message and trying to build a case, what does a lawyer do? A lawyer starts building a case surrounding things. When we start to try to build a case for why a message is true, we start building facts, do we not? The author of this book uses facts associated with their prior history to build an argument throughout the book that Christ is superior, that this is a superior covenant, and that no one should falter from it. Thoughts and comments? I've done most of the talking, now it's time for you. The Jewish Christians would have been faced at this time with significant persecution. None of us in our lifetime have ever experienced anything like they would have experienced. What happens to people when they experience significant traumas? Oftentimes they'll go into depression. They'll be faced with aspects of their life that they'll question. These Jewish Christians would have been no different than us in those types of same experiences. To have watched a brother crucified and burned at a stake would have been horrifying. That would be very difficult to walk away from and carry one's faith with them in the same mentality. When we look at in our own lives and how instances of Christians that we've known our entire life that have been examples of faith to us fall away due to some event, infidelity, issue within the family associated with some other type of sin that forces them to make a decision of, am I going to stay because of what's true, or am I going to go with the family ties that draw me together? These Jewish Christians would have no doubt had those same types of pulls. Doug? And we have example to that used in biblical comparison to the refining of gold, in that as you refine gold, you burn away the dross itself and it becomes purer and purer. So the fire itself is the persecution, so to speak, and it helps purify what's left behind it. It can go both ways, but it depends on generally the heart of the person that's being affected by it, and in some cases the instances of what they're facing at that moment. Right. The handout that you have has a timeline on it. We've often seen the timeline that points to the cross as the pinnacle of the change, and then following that. It's important to look at that in the Old Testament, all of the prophecies are pointing forward to a better covenant. It's talked about in Jeremiah, the stone that set in order the builders will be used, cornerstone. And then we look at each of these other passages that they tie together. They point to a better future. Those are all key as to, right. Now, it's a very... Brother Kraft's point is that they would have experienced the temple, they would have experienced the worship in the temple, the work with the priests, and when you physically experience something, it becomes more real to you than when you are having to rely upon something that's unseen. That's very, very true. And quite candidly, their entire background is built upon the things that they had seen. They were told to recognize the miracles that had occurred in their past and to believe based off of those. Now, when Christ came, what did he do as a way to persuade people that his message was true? Miracles. John's book makes many other signs and wonders were Lorenzo's point surrounding habit and muscle memory and training. We often fall back on all of those things as when we're faced with a difficulty, okay, what do I do? Oh, I cut myself. I go grab a Band-Aid. Immediate responses that we've developed and conditioned ourselves to respond to. The New Testament is very different from the Jewish religion of old, and the behavior that they would have experienced with that would have been very, very different. Good point. Any other comments this morning? Our next class will be Sunday morning. We have Singing Wednesday night, and we'll pick up there in chapter 1 of Hebrews. Thank you.